We begin a week of programs centered around the memory of Rabindranath Tagore. For at the conclusion of this week, India and countries around the world will celebrate the 100th anniversary of his birth, May 6, 1861. The Asia Society of New York, headed by John D. Rockefeller III, recently arranged a large public meeting in honor of the approaching centennial. The Society invited as guest speaker America's leading poet, the much-loved Robert Frost. At 86 years of age, the junior of Tagore by only 14 years. They knew one another, and as Frost addressed a large gathering in New York City the other night, he spoke of those memories. For the next few days, I want to bring you excerpts from his remarks. As you know, if you're familiar with his poetry, Robert Frost expresses himself in a simple, forthright manner, combining bluntness with perceptiveness. To open the memorial meeting, Mr. Rockefeller read two messages. The first from Prime Minister Nehru of India.
I'm glad to learn that the Asia Society is paying a tribute to the memory of Rabindranath Tagore. I send my greetings and good wishes to this occasion. Tagore is honored as a great poet and a great humanist in other countries. To us in India, he was something even more than that. He was a great man in every sense of the word, and he was one of the principal architects of what India is today. His influence on people of my generation was so pervasive that it is difficult to measure it. I feel what he wrote and said is of great significance in the world today.
The second message read by Mr. Rockefeller came from the White House, President John F. Kennedy.
I am heartened by the news that in this 100th year after the birth of Rabindranath Tagore, various centennial committees are introducing Tagore's plays, writings, and works of art to new audiences throughout the United States and indeed throughout the world. In this way, his genius, the nobility of his style, the depth and richness of his spirit will be experienced and appreciated by ever-widening audiences. Robert Frost is a particularly happy choice to voice American tribute to the memory of Rabindranath Tagore and to the nations which gave Tagore to the world. It will be, I am sure, a deservedly sensitive and appreciative tribute. It is one I wish that I could hear.
Now to Robert Frost, who spoke in his usual informal manner of poetry, poets, philosophy, and Tagore.
I have had in my lifetime great friendship with the makers of makers or restorers of two or three nations. I've grown to be quite almost a statesman from associations. And I've begun to feel more statesmanlike in my own country lately. So that some of my friends who don't like the word politician are worried about me. Never mind them. Now, it was with Ireland, friends with the poets that made Ireland. I knew them quite well, and I knew best of all in India, Rabindranath Tagore. And it's interesting, it's fine to hear that he's still a living force in India. That moves me a good deal. I knew he was a force in a great deal that was going on. And I saw enough of him to understand how, and his friendships and his affairs at home. Now I can look at him in two ways. as a great nationalist, maker of one who took part in the making of a nation. And I guess that's my first interest in him. I'm a terrible nationalist myself. Formidable. And I can't see how one can be international unless there's some nations to be inter with. And the clearer and distincter, the better. Now, it was always very interesting to me with Tagore to see what his essence was. He was two things, as I say. First, let's think of him as a statesman, and then think of him as a person who declared himself an artist for art's sake. That was his talk. And he wasn't afraid of that. One of his favorite words was ineffable. You may know that only in a humorous way, you know, they say of a person that he's an ineffable snob. But it's a beautiful word, and it's a word that has the beyondness about everything, you know. When Job says, "Thou art more to me of God," he's speaking of God, or he, I guess how does it go in the Bible, "Thou art more to me than my necessary food." Now, he doesn't take away from the necessary food. It's necessary, but that is beyond, you see. And you come right up to that edge of the ineffable all the time in poetic thinking. One villain I know puts his arms around me whenever we mate and says, "I gave him a soul." He means by that I made him a radical some way without meaning to. But it's something, you see, vague like that, ineffable. And he's one of my boys, you see. I'm this kind of person. I entered into poetry by being caught up in its catchiness. That's my life. Caught up in its catchiness. I might say that of Tagore, that I think he played instruments. He had talks of music a great deal, and there's something to poetry for him. It's hard to tell in translation, isn't it? But from what I knew of him, it was the same thing. So many people we know in the educational world who unfortunately never got into poetry till they studied their way into it. Another curious word that's always coming into Tagore's poetry is loneliness and the silence. I remember his friend Yeats was always saying that the true poet would never publish a poem. It was silence deep in the soul. That's this ineffableness, you know, that you mean something that you just come up the edge of. Now, I'll tell you, I won't recite the Tagore ones because they're in free verse and translated and I don't know how to. But I'll tell you about one or two of them. Here's one about a boy he calls a runaway. You should know it. It's a boy that's just a runaway. And the end of it is, "Not all the love, affection, and desire, the desire tempered with affection, could chain him to the world, society, family, anybody." It was one thing after another in the story. He simply leaves. There's no antagonism, no quarrel with it, but he just leaves. He's gone away into the ineffable. When you think of it, one of the differences between the East and West is that the East is maybe more ineffable than the West. But let me tell you about that. I talked with him about it once, years ago. many people think meditation is the same thing as contemplation. That's because they hadn't thought enough. But we made the distinction. The West is more meditative. The East is more contemplative. I like to say we Westerners meditate revenge and meditate mischief and meditate the thankless muse, meditating something to do. And the contemplation is something to be lost in, to lose yourself in, so as to find yourself. That it's a spiritual difference. Mind you, it's on both, but the emphasis is a little eastward is contemplative and westward is meditative. Now, those are all scattered off through poetry. I could go on indefinitely showing that thing, how you lead up. And what I'd like to say at the end of it, that these poets push you right up to an edge of somewhere, a verge, where you are supposed to take off with your arms, you know, as if they were wings into the nowhere. And the in India, they call that nirvana. We hardly have a word for it here. It's Mr. Chakravarti and I have been talking that over in late years somewhat. It's the only nothing that is something. Off into the only nothing that is something. And you do it with your arms as if they were wings, and that is, you break your life on it. No, that's what life is. The object of education and poetry and the humanities, the whole thing, is to raise trouble and sorrow to a higher level of regard. Not make them any less trouble or sad, but to lift them to a higher regard. And I read Tagore over, looking over him again, Mr. Chakravarti's book, and I find him playing with the paradoxes. Let's say this too, that everybody assures me these are more poetical in Bengali than they are in English. And he says so himself. He used to say that. He was almost sorry he translated them into English, because the most national of the arts is not painting, not music, that can go over, not sculpture, it's poetry, because the only reason for keeping England alive and the English language alive is to keep Shakespeare from being translated into Volapük or Esperanto. and the Bengali is the same, you see. That must be kept, see. That must be preserved. That's what's... There's two... In India, of course, much of the intercourse between the different kingdoms and all that has had to be in English, but ultimately the great Bengali language must be what preserves the poetry that's been written in it, and it must be kept alive.
And on this note, we leave Robert Frost for today. But tomorrow, we will have more excerpts from his recent talk in New York at the Tagore Centennial Meeting. We remind you that all this week, Report to South Asia will commemorate the life of Tagore. Now, this is VOA South Asian editor Anita Iowas, concluding today's Report to South Asia. Yesterday, we brought you the first part of a recent talk by the American poet Robert Frost. He spoke at a large public gathering in New York City in honor of the 100th anniversary of the birth of Rabindranath Tagore. A fellow poet, a contemporary, for Frost is now 86 years of age, and a friend. Today, more of the informal comments of Mr. Frost. He has been speaking of Tolstoy's belief in pacifism, and how deeply it influenced the thinking of Gandhi. Here again, Robert Frost.
That's why Gandhi, it was under his influence, I think he came on the idea that one way to win a war was to was to invite people to take your life as a martyr and see it, and dare them to do it. That's why they won that war. I don't think Christ was as conscious of it as that, but Tagore had been, I mean, Gandhi had been to Oxford. And he knew what he was doing. And you know, I thought the tall building here in New York City, dedicated to peace, was dedicated to that idea that it was going to win without arms, without force. But it's taken arms. Taken arms. I'm shocked. And it's talking about force, using force. The other attitude, the Quaker one, is to drop your arms, do as Christ did, and win by martyrdom. To win by martyrdom. And as the world goes more liberal, the martyrdom is only on the half shell anyway. They don't have to it. And a liberal country like England can't carry it out. No, it doesn't quite want to in the face of the Christian nations. Well, that has a see the way the statecraft and the inevitable come together in a thing like that. It's never been tried. I met some young Quakers the other day, who are some officials in Quakerdom right now, and I said, "Are you for no fighting at all?" "Well, we should be," they said. See. That's their doctrine. But General Green, one of our chief generals in the Revolutionary War, was a Quaker from Rhode Island, you know, and quite a fighter. He was maybe the second rank general in it all, but a Quaker. And that's, again, you might say, what would he say? He'd shrug and say, paradox. See? And poets are like that, too. They're always shrugging and getting ironical and playful about paradoxes and contradictions. Am I inconsistent? Well, then they quote Emerson on the subject, you know. And so I am inconsistent, that's all. Just a little more of my approach to Tagore. His poetry goes a good deal further away from the West, you know. Many of our poets were more like him than I. I just happened to know him well and had some talks with him. As for being national, you see, I've had a poem kicking around all over the country lately, thanks to the president, about nationalism. It's about our beginnings, how we ceased to be colonial to the British. And our circumstances were quite different from India's. It was quite a different story. But it was, you know, a break, that same sort of thing. And in fact, I think we led the way in declarations of independence. Everybody wants to declare now. And they're all declaring all over the place. But India's done it with great dignity and great power and to the general admiration. Tagore, as I say it, I'm proud to be in on the setting up of a great nation, to have had friendship with it. Isn't it funny to have lived through all that? Ireland. Now I'm just home from Jerusalem, where I've seen some more of it. And everybody conscious of the enterprise, the air full of enterprise. Everybody, and what they call, you know, what I never use the word, but what they call dedication. And I heard one sort of fellow beginning to fail a little, a professor, and he wondered how long the dedication would last. He was going weak. And some of them, some I know in Ireland have done it. I don't know how far we've gone, but sometimes when somebody says a certain kind of vicious thing, you know, that sounds like going down. I tell you what they say so often, scientists and all, and good people, They either say, we got to have a more guided democracy. Guided democracy, that's a bad, dangerous slip. Then they say, haven't we got to be a little more collective? And they're beginning to ease off, you know, about it, get ready for the change. And there are other things that I won't bring up. I think I better leave that now. I better get my food. Right. But mine is this way. I'll tell you how the adventure of mine. It was used in an anthology of American poetry in England as the frontispiece. And that shows again the liberality of England, because it's the story of our break with England. And I'm going to say it to you, because we're thinking about the break of India with England. And the first line applies. The land was ours before we were the land's. She was our land more than 100 years before we were her people. She was ours in Massachusetts, in Virginia, but we were England's, still colonials, possessing what we still were unpossessed by. Possessed by what we now no more possess. Something we were withholding made us weak until we found out that it was ourselves we were withholding from our land of living, and forthwith found salvation in surrender. Such as we were, we gave ourselves outright. The deed of gift was many deeds of war to the land, vaguely realizing westward, but still unstoried, artless, unenhanced, such as she was, such as she would become. Now you see, the only difference between ours and India's was that ours was many deeds of war, little deeds of war, Washington's and Green's and all that, the Quaker that I spoke of. But in England they said, I added to the poem when I recited it over there, that your colonies are going the same way, one at a time. And they said, oh yes, they're ripening off, but you fell off green. That's that one. And then this next poem I'm going to say to you, has no real connection, but it goes off into the avatar, goes off into an Indian word or two. You see, of course, we, all of us Yankees in this northeast corner of the country, were brought up on Emerson, who was brought up on or that kind of thing. I am the doubter and the doubt. You know, they reckon ill, that's the Brahmin, the Brahma is, they reckon ill who leave me out. When me they fly, I am the wings. I am the doubter and the doubt. And I the hymn the Brahmin sings. That came on Boston at a certain time, disturbed all the Bostonians trying to understand it, and they all became Brahmins. And now to this day. That's a poem I published, puzzled over a good while. The last stanza in it is, the strong gods pine for my abode, and pine in vain the sacred seven. But thou, meek lover of the good, find me and turn thy back on heaven. That's a hard one for a Christian, but you want to hear what it means? I won't tell you all of it, it's too much. I found it out slowly by reading a good many things, but the interesting thing is that turning your back on heaven is the puzzle. Turn your back on heaven, it means that even in heaven, see, as an angel, you're not sure to get born, not to get born again. See, you aren't out of it, you aren't, it got into the only nothing, the something. Into nirvana. And he observed all that doctrine, and that you didn't help your case if you're an angel. You got to get out of being an angel even. You didn't want to be a monkey. You didn't want to be a person. You didn't want to be an angel. You didn't want to be anything but lost in nirvana. And I wonder how much you've known that. I've lived by that somewhat, thought about it a good deal. You're lost. You see, the word lost is another Tagore word. He had a great deal of the love of all humanity, but he had a very, very... He loved everybody but his enemies. And he was quite positive about some of that. It was very interesting to hear it. Very, very positive. And he had a kind of indulgence of his enemies. Now, I like a lot of people I don't approve of. Because I might want them in a poem as my villains. And that he had that kind of nature. And that's all through his writing, too, the indulgence of people at quite at variance with himself. He talks a great deal about God, you know, God. The boy came to me lately and said he was down at Harvard studying philosophy, but there wasn't a philosopher in the place. And I said, I know why you say that, because they don't think about God anymore. All they do is talk mathematics and epistemology, words and things. They never mention God. And philosophy's God's always been the great, you know, the great central word in talk. For instance, here, let me show you how often it comes. Be not ashamed, my brothers, to stand before the proud and the powerful with your white robes of simpleness. Let your crown be of humility, your freedom the freedom of the soul. See again, this is where we're dwelling tonight. Build God's throne daily upon the ample barrenness of your poverty, and know that what is huge is not great, and pride is not everlasting. He does. He maybe believed more than I did that something could be done about it. It's awful slow, isn't it? Slow world. You got to, while you're waiting for it, you got to believe. Notice, take my word for it, that the main thing is to lift our regard for suffering and sadness. That's all. By thought and poetry and all that. Lift our regard, not lift the sorrow, not lift the sadness, but lift our regard, our thoughts about it.
Tomorrow we continue with comments of Robert Frost as he spoke recently of Rabindranath Tagore to a large audience in New York City. The meeting was sponsored by the Asia Society of New York in commemoration of the 100th anniversary of the birth of the Indian poet and philosopher. I remind you that all this week, our programs will honor this anniversary.